The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Really starting in the most simplest way and going actually to the most complex of the teachings, which is looking directly at the mind and how it works. So I thought I would start tonight. I was in Boulder, Colorado, teaching a 10-day of, I don't know, about 5-6 weeks ago, and someone gave me something I thought was quite humorous that would be perfect for this particular community. And it's a computer haiku. Apparently in Japan, they have replaced the impersonal, unhelpful Microsoft error message with haiku poetry messages. Here are 16 actual error messages from Japan. Your file was so big, it might be very useful, but now it is gone. The website you seek cannot be located, but countless more exist. And this is probably my favorite one. Chaos reigns within. Reflect, repent, and reboot. Order shall return. Program aborting. Close all that you have worked on. You ask far too much. Windows NT crashed. I am the blue screen of death. No one hears your screams. Yesterday it worked. Today it is not working. Windows is like that. First snow, then silence. This $1,000 screen dies so beautifully. With searching comes loss and the presence of absence. Quote, my novel, not found. The Tao that is seen is not the true Tao until you bring fresh toner. Stay the patient course. Of little worth is your ire. The network is down. A crash reduces your expensive computer to a simple stone. Three things are certain. Death, taxes, and loss of data. Guess which has occurred. You step into the stream, but the water has moved on. This page is not here. Out of memory, we wish to hold the whole sky, but we never will. Having been erased, the document you're seeking must now be retyped. Serious error. All shortcuts have disappeared. Screen, mind, both are blank. Got a copier? This is a poem. It's called The Many Layers. Balanced on the head of a pin, falling to one side, grasping some thin thought, dragging it along in this river of time. Last night's sunset lighting up the silhouette, glued to a moment in time. Where did you learn to say that sunset was better than this? Who taught you this was a solid world? Who taught you holding on tighter would work? Who taught you, you of all people, to be so special, defying the laws of birth and death? Clouds are covering the sun today, but does that mean the sun is not shining? So, path. This path is simple and has some very simple necessities. We can say disciplines. And the first of these disciplines is that we have to be able to, they use the word shamatha, or one-pointedness of mind. And so the fundamental training here is based on that we find a way to train the mind to really be simple so it can collect itself. Now, a lot of times the practice says, oh, we have to go to the breath or the body. But it's also about our lives, that somehow we have to be able to, they talk about meditation and post-meditation. And that the meditation itself is a way that we focus ourselves for a short or long period of time. But there's also post-meditation. And post-meditation means that if you're really busy and running in 10,000 directions, it's really hard to settle the mind. And so it actually has to, this post-meditation is as important a lot of times as the practice itself. So when you sit, if you sit in the morning or whenever you sit, it's important to move slowly afterwards. You know, allow things to pace themselves from the practice. So it's really about how do you kind of make it simple. You know, we are so complex, and there's so many different levels from, you know, I don't know, from, you know, from cell phones and text messaging and you name it. It's this constant kind of almost electronic chatter, but also mental chatter that's going on. And the practice is saying, can I suspend that for a while? But then also, is there a way that I can actually hold it in a larger sphere in some way? And this is a discipline. It's certainly a discipline. And it means that we have to look at choices and how we choose to incorporate what's important to us, you know? And if what's important to you is to find some steadiness, and it's why you come here, in a sense, some stillness and some insight. But that primary factor of stillness also means that it has to have the nature of simplicity in the outer activity of what happens afterwards. This practice, in the sense of insight, only works when there is a mind that's collected and there's some tranquility or steadiness that then can actually observe what it is that's going on. And that's really the insight. And so I can't encourage you enough to find, you know, whether it's great, like the Tibetans always have these malas that they, you know, are using it for mantras. And it's great to have some way to constantly be collecting the mind. You know, it is, and I think in all cultures, just about all cultures, whether it's the Greek worry beads or, you know, they have them actually throughout the Eastern world anyway, that they use some way of just something that is repetitive and keeps the mind connected to the body in some way. When there is that steadiness, and when you've collected yourself to a certain degree, then there are levels of insight which this is all based on. And the first of these insights is really based on looking at what is known as the characteristics. And these are kind of the truth in our life. And we could go around as insight practice and simply name with these characteristics of what was happening in a moment. You know, so we could actually use them as ways to wake up to what's occurring. And they're really simple, and probably the most important one in the sense of something to notice is impermanence. You know, we see it in our physical world, we see it in our bodies, we see it in kind of the chaos sometimes that we run in, that we can recognize it, and that we can simply, when that insight is there and there's enough collectedness, and the mind is aware and awake enough to notice the nature of what it's experiencing. And so it has to be able to know what is happening. And this is it's a simple noting or labeling that's happening. We also, just because of really the afflictive emotions or disturbing emotions that we have, we get angry, we get afraid, we get jealous, we get desiring or longing, that these states come along, and that they are also a part of the kind of the world we live in and our reactions to that world. And what is our experience when those come up? And traditionally they talk about it as that's when we note our own kind of contraction, our own suffering. That happens when these disturbing emotions somehow take root or grab a hold of us on some level. There's also the third one, which is a little more complicated in some ways, because it's based on that... we notice that in this moment, that what we know as ourself is simply a consciousness that identifies. So there's the awareness and some experience, whether it's a thought or whether it's a body sensation or the breath, they talk about it as the mere self. It simply arises due to causes and conditions. And so we're not trying to manufacture ourselves out of this. We're just seeing the nature that that self is a relative thing that arises due to causes and conditions. Yeah. And this gets a little tricky. But it's something that we can also, when we notice it, we notice when we identify that we actually can let go of it. The same way we can let go of the suffering, and the same way we can be informed by the impermanence. So these are kind of the kind of the foundation of insight practice. Now tonight I want to also take it to another level. This is the kind of traditional practice, and right now I came down from Vajrapani. I was just teaching with Gil for the last 10 days, and I'm in retreat there, getting ready to. I'm going out exercising in the morning, 2 hours to get ready to leave in September to go to Nepal and then Tibet, to do this circumambulation of the sacred mountain, which is, you know, sort of 18,600 feet or something like that, the pass there. So I'm really trying to look at what is it that's looking at this, you know, that somehow the mind itself, right now, what is it that you're noticing? Is that there is a cognizant awareness, you know, and that means that simply that the awareness itself, that when you become you wake up to what the mind is observing, you know, whatever it is, there, that awareness has a luminosity to it, you know, and there's also a knowing that's there. So you can know that you're awake to what's happening in the moment. You know, so this is, they call it looking directly at mind or pointing directly at mind. You know, now what is the nature when we begin to cognize, in a sense, through this awareness? What is the awareness itself? Is it something? Is the mind something? No. Yeah. Or is it something that's just in relationship to everything? And there are questions we have to ask. What is it? You know, what thoughts? What are they? You know, what are they? You know, they have a shape, they have a color, they have a form, they have anything, you know? So we begin to take and turn the mind on itself, and begin to, in a sense, investigate. We can know that there's the cognizance, so there's a knowing that's there. And that knowing, and in Thai, it's yogap ru, which translates as just there with the knowing. So that knowing is there. And that knowing has a certain, we could say, luminosity or brilliance. When we look at it, you know, the awareness itself is energetic, you know, and the knowing of it is linked to it. So you can't separate the cognizance and the awareness out. They go together. Now, what gets interesting when we start really asking questions of what are we looking at when we're looking directly at the mind? Does it have flavor, color? Does it have, our thoughts, are they coming from somewhere? No. Where is all this coming from? And so we begin to start questioning if the mind has no place it's located. We can't find a location. Then there is a question. What's happening here? There's seeing going on, there's hearing, there is thoughts, there are different feelings in the body. You know. They all have the nature, back to the insight, of what? They really just arise due to these causes and conditions in a moment, and they're changing all the time. There's no way of somehow we want to string them together. But the question is, are they, you know? They're due to causes and conditions. I don't argue there. But what is it that's knowing this, you know? And what is being known, you know? Now, from a perspective of mind looking directly at the mind, it actually is looking at something that the phenomena that's happening, it's questionable. Is it real? You know, from the mind's point of view, you know, all it can do is experience actually momentary flickerings where there's the consciousness and kind of the self that arise in a kind of dualistic manner, you know. But what is this you're seeing? What is this you're hearing? Is this something, or is it part of the mind that's the thoughts have no place? None of this really has any place. So what is it? So they talk about it in terms of cognizant emptiness. So there's an awareness of the capacity to let go of everything. So it says that you have the power when you understand looking at mind, that whether afflictive emotions arise or any thoughts, you have the power to let go of it. Because we question the reality of what's happening. Okay? I'm not saying this is easy. I'm just saying this is pointing directly at the mind. Now, there's two aspects here. One says I can let go of it. Therefore, it says that what I see here is they use the word emptiness in Buddhism. It's a difficult word, because in essence we see it as a negative. And there's another way of looking at this, and it may be just moving the word. You could say possibilities. Okay? There's always potential. But it's not something. Okay? So there's always potential, but it's not something. Because the mind, when we look at it, we can't find where it is. So there's infinite potential here. That's pretty cool. Okay? And we have the power, because of the infinite potential, to actually, whatever arises, we can let go of it. It's okay. This is not a problem. When the mind looks at the mind, there's not any fear. Okay? It's a feeling. It can't be there. All that there is the knowing of these things that are passing by. So we can let go of it. Now, what's also true is, I always use this term, I can't grab one molecule in this room and run out of this hall and take it anywhere. Okay? There's no way I can do that. None of you can do that. Okay? So what is that saying? If it's saying that this potential is questionable, the reality of it is questionable, there's also the other side to this. And it says that what you see here is non-separateness. So it was actually an illusion that we made up saying I'm separate. Okay? So what you're looking at when the mind looks at itself is a unified field. It's not separating out. That's left brain business. Meditation, has some of that, but it's more based on this a unity field, this non-separateness, and how we see the potential and how we let go of it. And therefore, when we start recognizing that there is no separateness here, what happens? They say, they use the word bodhicitta, which is really this this recognition of non-separateness is a thing of the heart. And the emptiness, that potential, is a thing of the mind. So you can let go. That's kind of cool. You have the potential to look into things and see the luminosity of it for what it is, without getting caught or lost in it. And at the same time, you can't not be connected. There is no way that you can separate out from this. That was an illusion. So you come to this place where you're really looking at when the mind looks back at itself, it knows, because it doesn't see what's real, it has no home, no place to concretize things, so I can let them go. You know, and on the other side of that is this simple heart. You know, they talk about it as this bodhicitta is that when you know there's no separateness, you can't. One person could be free and another is not. It can't. This is not a field that you can take something out of. So we're all connected. You know. We can all learn how to let go. We can use that wisdom factor. But because we're connected, then we have to readjust this idea of separateness and getting out of this. So there's a natural sense of connectedness, cooperation, this kind of unity field, that begins to become part of the maturity of how this practice works. You know, because when you look at it, you start to let go of our kind of self-identity of who we imagined ourselves to be. I say imagined. You know. There's a natural tolerance, a natural sense of patience. One of the I heard recently a translation from the Pali of the word dukkha, which is suffering. And the du was im, and the ka was patience, impatience. And how so much we look at that causes us discomfort is due to the impatience. But if you recognize this kind of heart and this unity field, then you're willing to hang out. You're willing to take the time. So freedom is really something that is based on how we see things, you know, and that really has to do with this wisdom factor. But once that wisdom factor, that mind pointing at mind, it can't. It recognizes its inability to separate out, and therefore it then in a sense surrenders, because that's really what happens. It surrenders to this kind of unity field. You know, I'm you, you're me, we're in this together, you know, and we have to work it out, you know, as a collective. And where does it go? It goes back to this idea that where I started was that somehow we have to find this collectedness in ourselves. A lot of times decisions are, for myself, have always been a big deal. You know, I'm kind of trying to weigh all this stuff all the time. And I realize so much of it is if I'm not collected, I'm not one-pointed, I don't see clearly what it is that needs to be done from a collective point of view. Fear is something that is actually is isolator, you know. And we're trying to work on this. We're trying to find some way to break down that isolation. And we need to work on this one-pointedness. We have to have insight into the simplicity of impermanence, of how we suffer, you know, and maybe how we cause others to suffer. You know? We begin to see then, Ajahn Chah used to say, he would just say, well, name that third one, he'd just say, empty, you know, empty of self, empty. This is a phenomena. So just let go. It's okay. You know. And that simple mind turning around and being awake to itself softens. You know. It has nowhere to go. You know. I guess that kind of pops enlightenment. But anyway, you know. But there's not anybody in the way either. You know, one kind of breaks through that. So, the many layers balanced on the head of a pin, falling to one side, grasping some thin thought, dragging it along in this river of time. Last night's sunset, lighting up the silhouette of yogis glued to a moment in time. Where did you learn to say that that sunset was better than this? Who taught you this was a solid world? Who taught you holding on tighter would work? Who taught you of all people, to be so special, defying the laws of birth and death? Clouds are covering the sun today. But does that mean the sun is not shining? So I thought we'd just do a few minutes of metta, of loving kindness. You know, it is the result of the insight. We practice it because we haven't got there yet. But the path itself through this is to kind of break this self-centered cherishing. You know. To see the nature of our mind, to see the nature of how things work. In essence, to begin to surrender and trust that this moment, this is enough. You know, and you are enough. You don't have to be something else or do something else. Be something else. You know. So the practice of this simple word, kindness, the Buddha said, there's no one who is more worthy of your love than yourself. Oh, it's amazing. Why? Because you are a reflection of everything else. To love yourself is to love the connection, the non-separateness. You know. to allow that love to hold your body, feel it, know it. This great wish, this wish for freedom and peace. For health and well-being. To have ease. To awaken this mind, heart. And so we can extend it. As we wish it for ourselves, we also hold this practice of non-separateness. May you be happy. May you be peaceful. May you be healthy and free from any inner or outer harm. May you have ease of being. May you be free. And then as the mind has no walls, we can extend it beyond the confines of this room out in all directions. Above and below, in front and behind, to each side, like a stone hitting a clear forest pool, rippling out in all directions with this, they call it the great wish, the wish that beings known and unknown to us, seen and unseen, beings of all time, that beings may be happy, that they may be peaceful, that they may be in harmony with the earth and the air and the ocean and each other, so that we can live in peace. We do this practice so that we may awaken for the benefit of others. And whatever merit or power or energy that through our moments of really of non-clinging, that we willingly share those with beings everywhere. May all beings everywhere be happy. Get hung up. Be free. You can do that.